Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Team, a weekly program for teens, families, educators, and other interested folks. 411 Team provides a forum to examine and discuss various issues and events that shape, challenge, and sometimes disrupt our daily lives. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Today we are joined by Dr. Lindsay Cormack, political scientist and author of the powerful new book, How to Raise a Citizen and What It's Up to You to Do to Do It. At a time when American civic knowledge is alarmingly low and young voters are the least likely to register and to turn out, Dr. Cormack offers us optimism and practical path forward. Her work shows us that raising civically engaged young people just requires curiosity, consistency, and real conversation at home. Today, we will explore how parents and educators can model civic values, help children understand government, and nurture skills and confidence they need to participate in democracy and clarity and courage. Joining me via Zoom platform from New York, I welcome Dr. Lindsay Cormack. Dr. Cormack, welcome to 411 Team. I'm so glad to talk with you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, same here. What motivated you to write How to Raise a Citizen?
So I have been a college professor for 10 years now, and I've been at Stevens Institute of Technology in all that time. Stevens is a wonderful school where we have really bright kids. Most of them study engineering. And when I started there, I got voluntold that I was also going to be responsible for our voter registration and voter turnout efforts for the school. I took this on, and we would do these things called ducks to the polls, where we would have our students walk to the polls, vote however they like, and then we'd have an ice cream party afterwards to sort of celebrate this coming of age thing. You're 18 now, you can participate in this system. But in doing that, without fail, every time, there are multiple students who are turned away because they're either not registered or they're not registered in that county. And that doesn't feel good. I saw students feel embarrassed among their peers. They were frustrated with the system. And I thought, if these are my students who are so smart, so good at doing tests, they go on to bright careers, and they're having these stumbles, I know it's going to be worse in other places. And so I took six research assistants, and we got started looking at the curricular decisions in every U.S. state, interviewing teachers in 47 U.S. states, looking at data on 8th grade and 12th grade and beyond. And it was a book that I originally thought was going to be, here's the states that are doing it well, and here's what we can learn. And it really became a book that was, no state is doing this that well. And instead, we really have to have these conversations in our homes and in our communities if we want things to feel and function better.
Wow. That's kind of mind-blowing that you came out with no state that was doing it well, which I guess my question would be, how severe, and I think you've answered it, is this a decline, or has it been that there's no state has ever been doing it well in the first place? Or so are we seeing a decline in civic knowledge among young Americans? Or is it just that it's always been that way and we just really haven't paid that much attention to it?
So what's interesting is that voter turnout among young people has gone up as soon as they've been able to vote at 18. As soon as we've passed the amendment that allows them to do that, there have been more 18-year-olds who have participated. However, the gaps between 18-year-olds and 65-plus are very wide. And so there's still fewer than a quarter of them that participated in this last midterm election that are 18 and 19 years old. In terms of how it's looked over time, the thing that gave me the most frustration is that we have the nation's report card where we assess fourth graders and eighth graders on a bunch of different subjects. And for the one that we assessed on civics in 1998, the scores are nearly identical now as they were in 1998, meaning we've had a generation of parents and teachers who could have been making things better, but for a variety of reasons. It's hard to get this done in schools, and our data show that over the last 30 years, kids haven't really gotten that much greater civics instruction, and that translates into lower self-efficacy, lower understandings of the system. And if you sum it up all together, only about 22% of our eighth graders have what's considered a proficient understanding of civics, and that's been pretty stable for 30 years or so.
Oh, now, before the 30 years, was it better?
Well, we don't have data from back then. Okay. And so that's hard to say in terms of what eighth grade achievement were. And so it's not as if there's like this golden heyday that we need to get back to. Mm. But I do think that it's really hard to get all of this work done in schools alone for a variety of reasons. And so if we want things to feel and function better, we have to look for outside solutions. And that's where the sort of route through parenting came up.
Okay. For, why do we see that young voters are less likely to register or to turn out? Even once we get them registered, they still don't turn out. What's going on? From your research and studies, what have you found is going on that they just don't participate? What are we missing as adults, as educators, as parents? Is it just that they are not recognizing their value? What is going on?
Yeah, so the best research on this comes from the Harvard School, where they've done surveys, nationally representative surveys of young people. And sometimes people will say, well, young people just don't care about this. That's mm-hmm. why they don't do it. 78% of young people say that they care about politics. They're interested in learning more. What we find is there's these systematic hurdles that are very hard for anyone to navigate the first time around. So, for instance, registering to vote. In some states, you can't register online, and so that means someone's going to have to print out a form, they're going to have to get a stamp, they're going to have to send it to a board of elections, and that's like a really hard task to ask a new 18-year-old to take on their own. That's something someone else should offer them a hand and show them how to do it the first time. It's also the case that in most of the way that we teach civics or government in politics, we usually do it in two waves. First, in seventh or eighth grade, kids are going to get their first like social studies or world history class. And then we mostly pull back until the second semester of your senior year of high school, where students will get a class called government. Mm-hmm. So unlike every other subject where we build and we layer from K through 12, civics, government, and politics really gets this dip in seventh or eighth, and then again in 12th grade. And that too little, too late approach means that students are really having to fend for themselves to figure out a whole host of things, despite the fact that most of the students who are educated in our system are going to stay here for the rest of their lives living under this government. And so it's not so much a challenge in their desire to do it. It's a challenge in their capacity because we don't give them the building blocks or the tools to see this through.
Well, what does that say about educators?
Well, I don't blame educators because I think one of the reasons it's really hard to get this done in schools and why we decided to make this a parenting book is that the school environment is very constrained. And what I mean by that is depending on what state you're in, some state legislatures will say, you can say this, you can't say that. You have to teach this way, you can't teach that way. So there's already a fraught environment around talking about politics that many teachers are very aware of. But they also have the ever-present pressure of the SAT and the ACT, especially at the high school level, as like the thing that their students are going to be assessed on. Neither one of those tests has any components of civics or social studies in it. And so something that we heard in talking to teachers is if it's not tested, it's not taught, which makes sense. You only have so many days before the test, so many hours in a day. If something's going to get squeezed, it's going to be things like civics. And then another really big challenge is parents themselves, especially after the pandemic. Teachers report that one of the reasons they shy away from teaching politics, government, or civics, even in the most even-handed way that you could imagine, is if a child hears something and tells a parent and that parent gets angry about it, they're going to make that teacher's life worse by either inflaming a Facebook group, emailing a principal, barraging the teacher themselves with text messages. And so that sort of culture of blowback is one where teachers would say, you know, it's easier for me to teach the life cycle of a butterfly versus how a bill becomes a law because no one's going to get mad at me about it. And so it's just a really hard environment to get it all done in the classroom. It's not a ding against our educators. They're oftentimes getting the least instructional hours in social studies themselves. And so we haven't really equipped them to do this task. And then we've put them in an environment that's just very fraught.
Yeah, that makes sense. You argue that civic engagement then begins at home. What does this really look like in practice if we're talking about it beginning at home?
So in terms of what a parent consciously can do in their home, is one of the things that we struggle with is having an orientation to politics that can be positive. Children oftentimes get a message that politics is negative. And if you hear people arguing and saying things like everyone in it is a liar or a cheat or they're egomaniacs or the system's rigged, it's not surprising that kids don't want to learn more about it if that's their initial take. So I make the argument that parents have a duty to their children to show them the good that government can do. And what I mean by that is if you have newly paved roads, government had a hand in that. If you can drink clean drinking water, government has a hand in that. If you have public schools you like, or parks, or senior centers, government has a hand in many things that make our lives better, but oftentimes go overlooked. And even in households where parents aren't engaging in sort of like this negative anti-government or anti-political talk, children's literature and media is rife with examples that are anti-government in nature. Think about any sort of television show that has children's audiences in mind, like a Paw Patrol or a Simpsons. Mm-hmm. They'll usually have a government character like a mayor, and that mayor fits one of two archetypes. The first is they're a bumbling doofus who, like, at the end of the day, the thing gets resolved, but it's not the mayor that fixed it. It's probably the protagonist of the show. Mm-hmm. Or archetype two is that they're sleazy and they're out to do harm to the place that they're meant to protect. And both of those sorts of views about what it is to be in government are things that our kids consume from a very early age. So parents have to counteract that. They have to take their kids to go vote with them so they can dispel the like mythology of what it is to do this act, to show them it's just this. They need to show people, their children, who are the politicians in our area. Let them know that they're just your friends and their neighbors. They're not nameless, faceless bureaucrats out to do ill to you. They're usually tryhards. They might not see the world in the same way you do, but they're just people. And so there's a lot that we can do to normalize what it is to be in politics and to celebrate it if we want our children to aspire to a better politics than the ones that we're currently inhabiting.
All right. You're tuned in to 411 Teen, and we are having a very informative discussion today with Dr. Lindsay Cormack, talking about civil engagement for our young folks. We're going to take a brief break, but we will get right back at you. And when we come back, we'll talk about how families approach disagreements at home. Tuned in to 411 Teen. Just tuning in, the program is 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Hollyfield, and I'm talking with Dr. Lindsay Cormack, political scientist and author of How to Raise a Citizen. Dr. Cormack, how should families approach political disagreement at home? You know, because, I mean, in such our polarized and it's a real complex political system today where you may see families, husband and wife, you know, grandparents really strongly disagreeing. And I've read situations where, you know, some of the family members aren't talking to each other. And how should families address that? How should they approach this? Suggestions you may have.
Yeah, so these are realities that many people are living through, which is you see the world differently, you have a disagreement. And the thing that we need to keep in mind for our children is they model us for what we do and for what we don't do. And so the first thing that I encourage parents to do is make sure that your kids can see you having a disagreement. Now, that doesn't mean you need to yell at someone, but It does mean that if you can normalize talking through your differences, and that doesn't mean I have to convince you that you're wrong and I'm right. It means let me see what it is to step into someone else's perspective and then also be able to share mine. But if our kids never see us having those sorts of conversations, they don't have a mental model for how to do it themselves. Like any other sort of parenting advice about arguing in front of children, you don't want to have something that escalates to violence. There's like no good that comes of that, whether that be physical violence or verbal violence in the term of derogatory things thrown around. Instead, what we want our kids to see is that, yes, there's going to be disagreement in life. Yes, we're going to want different outcomes, but we can talk through these things. And part of that is not just making sure our opinions are known, but it's listening. And so we have to do that in front of them and with them. Mm-hmm. Every parent knows their kids best. And so some of your kids might want to debate with you, engage in that. Some of them might not want that, but they have to be willing to see what that conversation is like. And they have a really good environment in your home to do it that they probably can't get anywhere else.
So what we're talking about really is that the parents and the adults and the kids' environment are modeling respectful dialogue.
Very much so. That's led with curiosity. And then something that I always say when you're asking your kids about politics, or sometimes they might come to you because it's sort of ubiquitous that they hear things. The first question I always say that you should ask is, what have you heard about that? And why I like this question and why I use it in my home and in my classroom is that it doesn't make a child defensive or have to justify their opinion or prove something to you. It just lets them set the table. What have you heard about that? It doesn't mean you've heard the right thing. It doesn't mean you've heard the end thing. But if you let them start there, you can start to see where their inputs are and build to a richer conversation instead of if you put them on the defensive, be like, well, why do you think that? What have you heard is a way better place to start.
When we think about civic education, share with us where you see the major gaps in the whole formal education process.
So it's really hard to say throughout the United States what a child is exposed to because we do not have a standardized civics curriculum. Instead, every state gets to do their own. So we have 50 different state civics curriculum. Within that, the states further devolve it sometimes down to school districts. The private schools are different than the public schools, are different than the parochial schools, are different from the home schools. So it's really hard to say what our kids are getting. But the modal style of delivery is one that heavily tilts towards history, and it lets kids see themselves as spectators in politics instead of participants in politics. And so if you were to ask educators about like what's the most effective pedagogical tool to teach kids about civics, they would tell you something like experiential civics, which is let the kids go figure out a problem in their neighborhood. Let them then grapple with who it is they're meant to talk to figure this out. Is it a council? Is it a mayor? Is it a commission? And then let them try to work out how they would get this thing solved. Oftentimes, they don't fix it. But in experiencing the process, they get to sense their own agency and how they might be able to do something in the future. That's not usually how we teach civics. We usually teach it as some figures, some dates, some key events, and then some concepts. And even then, it's just in 7th or 8th grade, and then again in 11th or 12th grade. And so we don't really give kids the time to grapple with these concepts in ways that we do for every other subject.
How can parents then, how can they introduce government and civics to very young children? Because I would think that the earlier they start, that the more equipped they are. So what would you recommend? Give us some examples of how they introduce government or, you know, again, the civics to young children. And when I say young, I mean, I'm talking about elementary age school.
Yeah. So in the book, I break it up into 5 to 9, 10 to 14, and 15 to 18. And in those young 5 to 9, you don't need to be sitting them down and lecturing them on like, here's how the government works. Here's the 3 different branches. At that point, it's all about imbuing a sense of positivity around the whole enterprise. So it's saying, you know, like, oh, isn't it so great that we have this park? I'm really glad that the city council decided to get a new swing. Or I'm really glad that we all got together in our mutual organization to like clean up this area. And so it's giving them a sense sense of like the people doing this work are trying to do good. And it's not to say there's never anything critical to point out, but they are going to get a lot of that criticism, even if you don't do it as a parent. So for those very young, it's teaching them there's good here, there's people here, and they're trying here, instead of they're out to do harm or to hurt you. That's what the very first youngest ones should be exposed to.
So many times we have these misconceptions that we operate under. And when I say we, again, I'm talking about the adults and educators in the system. Would you share the misconceptions that you have encountered that parents and educators tend to hold?
Well, oftentimes my students are surprised to know how little money there is in really consequential offices. Mm-hmm. So like if we look at state legislators, so people who are going to your state capital, who are making laws that only pertain to your state, but can be about really consequential things. So like access to reproductive health care, access to gun licenses, drug policies, things that change our lives. In many states, these people are only working on a part-time basis, and they're not well compensated at all. And so oftentimes we'll think like, oh, these people who are doing government, they're all these big wigs. Mm-hmm. That's not true at the state and local level for the most part. And so it's usually people who are essentially volunteers of what they think that they can do to make life a little bit better for everyone else. And that notion that there's like, you know, evil people who are out there to get ahead for themselves. In state and local politics, the data just doesn't bear it out because it doesn't really pay and it's not really a career trajectory for most people.
Yeah, yeah. When we talk about teens and civic involvement, civic education, what have you found to be the issues that really do matter to teens today? I mean, what are they concerned about? And then I guess the flip side, and how can we adults meet them where they are?
I'll tell you something that I found to be the most troubling is that a lot of teens that I encounter already come at the idea of governments with this notion of being jaded. Like they don't come at it from a hopeful, optimistic, here's what could change in the future, but instead of this sense of like dread that the die has already been cast and life is not going to get better and things are going to look worse. I don't think this is all to blame on politics itself. I actually think a lot of things that do this work is sort of our algorithmic media environment that's mostly done in those connective like antisocial or social media platforms, because it sort of stresses things that are negative or things that tend to get more outrage tend to get more virality. And so our students, young people, come to my class with sort of this notion of baked in dread instead of like, wow, isn't it amazing that I've just turned 18 and I'm now able to fully participate in this system? And in terms of what they care about, they have as wide a range of cares as any number of adults, no matter their age. Some of them are deeply invested in gun policy. Some of them really care about access to affordable health care. Some of them care about what they're going to be able to do after work or after college. Like, is AI going to take their jobs or not? So they have a wide variety of things that they care about. But the thing that is most troubling is this notion that it can't get better and life will get worse.
And we have to, yeah. And that contributes to it, I'm sure. I can see it as you're talking. I'm thinking, yes, she's right, because they certainly have that attitude. You know, looking at all that is going on today, they may not be interested in participating in government or politics, just given the status of it being so polarized. How can families discuss elections without, do you have suggestions, becoming overwhelmed with the kids, overwhelming the kids, I guess is what I want to say. Because I know in talking to people about this, a conversation I was going to have with you, several parents raised the issue of, well, I don't want to overwhelm my kids with this stuff. It's everywhere. It's all over the news. I want them to be aware, but I don't want to overwhelm them. And I thought I'd ask you, see if you had any suggestions of how families can discuss elections and politics with not freaking the kids out.
Yeah, and I actually I hear that a ton when I
Oh,
do
do
these
you?
talks for
Okay.
PTAs. I hear from lots of parents, you know, like, oh, I just want them to maintain their innocence. I want them to stay children for longer. But it actually seems to be doing a counterproductive form of not really protection by not engaging on the subject, but really underpreparedness. And so we don't need to like grapple with every different election. You know, it doesn't matter what happens in a different state than yours for the most part. But if you do have an election coming up, like we just ended an election season here in New York City, some of my colleagues had election seasons in Virginia and they were dealing with their own things. To have your child understand the process as one that is a pendulum, that if you don't get the outcome you like today, the best thing about American politics and being in a democratic republic is that it can swing back or in another direction. And so if you understand that, like, the game is that it gets to be played repeatedly for the rest of your life, it shouldn't be that one outcome is overwhelming. And in terms of getting sort of like a drowned sense of like, oh my God, there's so much coverage on this, we don't have to live and breathe this every day. No one has to do that. That doesn't feel good. It doesn't help us get better outcomes. But if you have kids who are in that like 13 and up age and you have an election happening, a really nice exercise can be, hey, why don't you spend 15 minutes and tell me what candidate you would pick and why? And let them loose on the internet. They don't know, you know, the party identification that matters, but let them go figure out how they would come to that decision. Doesn't have to be the same as yours, doesn't have to be a rationale that you really agree with, but letting them see what that process is of engaging with a subject or engaging with an office and figuring it out, that can be really good practice.
How important is it? Well, we talk about the parents, but do you have any resources that you would recommend for parents? As far as the Constitution, knowing the Constitution, being familiar with the rule of law, because I think a lot of parents aren't comfortable in talking about this because they aren't sure. So is there any app or anything that you would recommend that parents use to find out or to educate themselves?
Yes,
I think your
and I
book was
actually.
excellent. Excuse me for interrupting, but you know, I said that and then I start thinking, yeah, well, your book, How to Raise a Citizen, would be very appropriate too. But you know, in addition to that.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say first is that I hear this from parents all the time. They're like, well, I
Okay.
don't want to lead my kids astray because I don't know that much. And I'm like, yes, I know. I've looked at the data. We weren't teaching it that well when you were in high school either. So, like, don't feel bad about that. But we're all capable of learning more. And so, the way that this book is set up is the
It
first
is
half is
excellent.
essentially here's the problem we have, here's how we got there, and here's some way out of it. And then the second half is a primer where I go over the Constitution, every article, every amendment. And then I go through things like federalism and other big concepts. And then I say, you know what? There's things that you're going to be able to figure out on your own that matter more to you. And we are awash in resources. We have so many different places to go. On my website, which is just simply howtoraiseacitizen.com, I have a resources tab where you can click through and see, oh, if you care about learning more about the courts, here's a good website for you and your kids. Oh, maybe you care about state politics, here's a good website. Maybe you want to have discussions better or have better debates. There's a bunch of different people who are doing this work. And so it's not something where I'm afraid that parents can't learn this. It's something where I'm afraid that we don't even see it as our task to do it in the first place. We think someone else is going to take care of it. Oh, they'll learn it in school.
That's
And
true.
so my plea to parents is to understand that you have a role here. You got to take this on because we're not doing enough in schools. And it's very hard to see a future where we can do enough in schools based on the constrained environment that schools provide.
Well, that indeed is true. And at this point, we do need to again talk about your book. I am talking with Dr. Lindsay Cormack. She's the author of How to Raise a Citizen and Why It's Up to You to Do It. And it is excellent. I mean, I didn't, we started talking immediately, you know, just discussing what needs to be done. But I want you to again share your website. I mean, it really is, and I'm not just saying that. I found it to be excellent. I found it to be, I learned some things. And I think that everyone can benefit by reading this. This is a must-have book. So where can we get the book? Share your website again for the listening audience. because it's very thorough. It's real clear. It looks at federal, state, and local matters. If you read this book and you have a firm grasp of this book, I don't think you really need anything else.
That is so nice of you to say.
I really liked writing it. I was impressed with how thorough it was. Okay, I'm really serious. I was just like, oh, wow, this is well done. If folks have just this, they won't need anything else. I think you covered everything. And you offered examples, you know, at the end of the chapter, what to do. So again, I'm not just singing your praises because you're on the program. I mean, this is a book that, in fact, I'm keeping it myself, and I'm keeping it for reference. Okay, so that lets you know how important it was to me. It was good.
Thank you. I really enjoyed working on it. It was something that once I was tenured, I had the space to do this. And I thought, this is the book I want to write. This is the thing that I want to communicate. I mean, seeing inside of academia and outside, here's how I want it to be done. So it can be purchased anywhere that you buy books. It's on Amazon and Bookshop and Barnes and Noble. And then on howtoraiseacitizen.com, if you want a signed copy, you can order it there and I'll sign it and send it off to whoever you want. I have people who are buying it for like new parents. So like grandparents will buy it for their children once they've had kids. I've had people who are buying it for parents when their kids are getting bought a bar mitzvahed. I just had someone who bought it for a child who was graduating from their degree program, getting a political science degree. And so I'm really happy to send along a signed copy to anyone who wants it. It has been a labor of love. And I couldn't have done it without raising a daughter myself. I have a 13-year-old, and when I was writing it, it was originally just going to be How to Raise a Citizen. And she's the one who said, no, Mom, you need to add and why it's up to you to do it. Because the point isn't just here's how you do this. It is that you must understand that if you want your kids to be able to fully participate in our politics, you're going to have to take on some of that teaching burden.
Well, again, it was excellent. Usually when I read a book, I pass it on to the library. But Leon County Libraries is not going to get this, okay? So sorry.
You wouldn't get him a different one.
Yeah. You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm talking with Dr. Lindsay Carmack. We are talking about civil engagement. We're going to take a brief break, but we'll get right back at you. It's time for Reflections with Raphael, a commentary from Raphael Hollyfield Wimmer, an honor student and gifted musician at the esteemed Girard Academic Music Program in Philadelphia, where he blends intellect with creativity. Whether he's striking keys, sounding drums, or sharing ideas, Raphael brings insight with rhythm, thought with heart, and a fresh perspective you won't want to miss. Reminding us that wisdom isn't just a matter of age, it's a matter of vision.
Hey y'all, this is Raphael, and you're listening to Raphael's Reflection. Today, I would like to talk about some of the major online trends and jokes and how they are affecting society. In every generation, there are staple slang words and jokes that everyone knows about. Well, maybe not everyone, but at least most kids and young people. Some of these jokes last decades, and some of them only a few weeks or months. The best example of this that you can see today is 6'7". If you don't already know, 6'7" is a joke that has no real reasonable explanation, but originated from a song called Doot Doot by a rapper from Philadelphia named Skrilla. Outside of the song, however, this joke has evolved and changed so much that it makes me wonder how much of an impact it has on mainstream media and what effects both 6'7" and other jokes of its nature will have in the future. It seems like in the past, jokes and phrases similar to 6'7" have occurred. I can't go into detail about that because obviously I wasn't there and don't know, but it seems that most of these jokes eventually die down, or they're only used within certain social circles or among specific groups of people. If this is the case, then what is so special about 6'7"? I mean, we're coming up on a year since its creation, and it's still thriving. Sure, there have been ups and downs. There are multiple times when 6-7 almost died out, like other similar jokes and trends of this time, but every single time it has made a revival. Whether it has been someone adding on to the joke, like 6-7 Mason or TikTok influencers, or it just randomly came back, it has never fully died out. Again, it drives me to wonder why. Well, I have a theory. I think that in order for something like 6-7 to continue to be relevant and popular in the media, it must change and evolve. The same way that as people, we must change with the times, these jokes have to undergo the same process. I mean, think about it. If someone you knew made a joke or said something that we're not supposed to say anymore in this day and age, they would probably be laughed at and ridiculed. So why wouldn't it be the same with these jokes? Like I said before, 6-7 has gone through so many changes, and now it means something so much different from when it first started. I think this shows us that as humans, change is not only healthy, but a necessary part of life. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed my reflection.
Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and contributors, and not necessarily those of WFSU Public Media.
What's the 411? You're tuned in to 411 Teen. I'm Dr. Liz Holyfield, and I'm joined by Dr. Lindsay Carmack, political scientist and author of a powerful new book, How to Raise a Citizen and What It's Up to You to Do It. I recommend it's good reading for everyone, so I strongly recommend it. Dr. Carmack, what are the core skills that you would identify that children need to become active citizens?
So I spell this out when I say, if you have a 15 to 18-year-old in your house, here are five things that they need to know before they leave your house so that they can fully realize all the power that they have within them in our system. One is they need to know how to register to vote. And that's not just registering to vote in the state that they live in. It's when they move away to college or if they move away to go to a job, it's registering every single time. So for those first few times, you have to make sure that they know how to do that. They also need to learn how to vote. So whether that's going to be in a state that you have voting by mail, or you're going to be showing up early voting, or you're going to be doing it in person, walk them through that process. Let them plan it out with you and map it out so that they're more likely to do it. I think every child should have read the Constitution before they turn 18. This does not happen in schools by and large. I teach an Intro to American Politics class, and every year I have maybe one student who's taken AP US Government who's done it. Most of my students haven't, and if they don't get a class like that in college, they'll probably go their whole life never having read the rule book. And just like any sort of game, a board game, a card game, it's way more fun and you'll be better at it if you read the rule book. So I think you should do that at least once. They also need to have a sense of what federalism is. The president doesn't control everything. Sometimes the state politicians are the ones who are making the choices. Sometimes it's local politicians, like if you're getting a new restaurant that's being zoned into an area that there wasn't previously restaurants. And so understanding that different levels control different levers of power is a thing that our kids will be better off knowing, because then they won't just get frustrated about things that happen in politics. And the last thing that I say that they need to do is they need to see and practice what it is to have a political conversation where they disagree with someone else. Life is never going to be easy if you go through it thinking everyone sees it the same way that you do. But you can be better at understanding difficulties if you have practice. And the home is a really good place to do that in, because we get them for the formative years. And we can do it with love. And we can do it in a way where they can be more effective when they go out into the world, make their own families, make their own friends, so that our politics feels better.
How do we help kids learn to disagree productively? And I always kind of touched on this, but I see that as a real major issue. Not getting angry, turning it into a fight, or whatever. How can they disagree, you know, productively?
So I think something that we need to figure out in our framework is oftentimes we frame political debates as zero sum, or you win, I lose, or it's like there's two sides and someone's going to crush the other side. but instead political debates in order to make a more perfect union for us to get better outcomes should not be about compromise, should not be about beating, but should be about collaboration. And so there are many things that good people will disagree about, and you can get to a better outcome if you think about it collaboratively. I'll give you an example. In my class, our students had just voted because New Jersey had an election, and some of them were shocked that they don't have to have a driver's license to prove their identity when they go to vote. And they thought, oh my gosh, this must be so insecure. Anyone could come impersonate me and vote. Where we had other students who are a bit older who'd done it in the past, and one who worked as a poll worker who was like, actually, we signature match and you do have to bring your identification the first time, but after that, you don't if you have your address. And so instead of saying like, oh my gosh, I'm right and this system is totally incorrect, they had a back and forth about why it is this way and how you're just balancing different competing interests. Is it a hassle for people to exercise a fundamental right or not? What about the security of elections? And I always encourage in my class, when we're done with something like that, we thank each other for doing it. Having something that comes back to thanking you for having that conversation instead of leaving in a huff or being mad that you maybe didn't see it in the same way. It's both about framing it differently, but also concluding it in a way that's positive.
What works from where you sit when trying to increase young folks' turnout, young folks who are registered, we've got them registered, but then what works, what are suggestions that you may share to community organizers, to the listeners, educators, parents, that may help them to increase the young folks getting out to vote?
Yeah, so we know that voting is habit-forming and contagious. And by habit-forming, what I mean is the greatest predictor of whether someone's going to vote or not in an upcoming election is if they voted in the most previous one, because they've sort of taken out the hard work of like, where is my polling site? How do I check in? How much time do I need to anticipate to be here? And so doing it once is the best predictor of doing it again. And if we want to get our young people to do it that first time, it's better if they do it as a social activity. If they say with their friends, hey, let's go vote. Mm-hmm. Or you have an ambassador, someone who looks like them who says like, yeah, we're going to go do this thing. It's not as effective for me to be like, you guys should vote, instead of saying like, hey, if you want to go vote and take a picture, that'd be great. You guys can celebrate that you did this really adult thing together. We also on our campus this last year did something that I was very proud of. Our student government invited 4 candidates for a seat that is representing our district just to come to campus, not to have a debate, not to give any speeches, but just to let students meet them, just so they could have their own sort of internal barometer sense of like, do I like this person? Do I not? Do I trust them? Do I think they're competent? They're not trying to persuade me of anything. They talked about what jobs they'd done in the past. They talked about how their advertising was going. And having that sort of sense that these are real people for real offices makes it that much more tangible for young people to say like, oh, actually, I can change this outcome. If me and all my friends get together and do this, that's a number of votes that these people otherwise wouldn't have had. So instead of just telling kids you should do it, make it a social event and let them be ambassadors to each other to get it done.
I know in your book you shared a number of activities or ways that parents could help their children see themselves as a part of the democratic process. You were talking about like taking them to PTA meetings, taking them to rallies. Would you share that? Because I found that to be very helpful. I mean, there are things in the community that are going on that, you know, do not cost any money that would parents could be involved in. It would be positive for the parent and positive for the child. Would you share those with the listening audience?
Yeah, so I see this as one of the ways that we're raising our kids to be athletes, not spectators. And if we want to raise them to be athletes, we have to show them what that playing field looks like. We have to give them that exposure so they're not just sitting on the sidelines. And this sort of suggestion is born out of my experience as a community board member in New York City. I sit on the community board here, which is an appointed position that's doing the very smallest form of local government, like granting liquor licenses, cannabis licenses, and doing sidewalk cafes and roadway cafes. There's other people on the board who do things around education policies and parks. And anytime that we have a meeting, when someone brings their children, that not only shows that child what these spaces are like, who's doing this work, but it reminds all the people doing the decision making that your constituency is not just the people who look like you, the people who you're interacting with. There's children in your community that don't have a say in this. And so your politics can be more responsible or responsive to whoever you're meant to be representing if you see them. For kids, they might find that some of this stuff is boring because a lot of it is boring even for adults. But they then do understand that it's not just some sort of like backroom discussion that a few people are making that no one has input or insights to, because most local forums are very communal in nature. And usually if you sign up ahead of time, you'll even get to speak for 2 minutes. We have young people who do that at our meetings. We had a meeting this last week where there was a fifth grader who wrote this big long letter, and he was like, I don't even think you're going to read through this whole thing. And then he showed up to the meeting with his parents. And I was like, thanks so much for sending this letter. And that shows them that government is responsive. And so it's just this important thing where if you can put kids in those spaces, it's not only good for them, it's good for the people who are doing that work.
What about the schools? I know that civic education is not important because it's not on the college exam boards or anything like that. But it is important, as we well know. And I know, for example, I'm kind of thinking, as I'm talking to you, all these things are running through, but I'm thinking about even when they have class elections, that would be a way of teaching our exposing kids to the various process. Do you agree? You think that's a good way in the younger stages of development?
Yes, absolutely. Having things like student government. And when I do these talks in schools, sometimes I'll do like an auditorium full of fifth graders. Mm-hmm. And when I ask them what they think about politicians, they will tell me negative things. They will say the things like the liars, the cheaters, the egomaniacs, self-centered. But then when I ask their student government to stand up, and all those kids stand up and they look around, and I say, now, what would you say about these people? And those are all, you know, like people who are trying hard, or they're charismatic, or they want things to be better for other people. And so student government can be an excellent way to get kids practicing the process of self-governance. I also know that in schools, sometimes it's really hard to deliver the message from the teachers themselves because they have to interact with students all the time. And so, you know, if they get into some sort of political discussion, it can be challenging if you like break some sort of trust and then have to rebuild it. That's why oftentimes schools will look to outside people to come in and do this work, because they can like dip in, have a special expertise, students can relate to them, but then not have to be with them forever. That's something that schools can avail themselves to. And I'll also say, in terms of funding for this sort of work, for the entire time in which I was writing the book, if you said how many dollars came from the federal government to the states through K-12 education to go to STEM, for every $50 that went to science, technology, engineering, math, only 5 cents went to civics. So we have been deeply underprioritizing and underfunding this. But there is reason to believe that we're going to have more money in the future. The day before this recent government shutdown, the Department of Education announced $153 million in grants that are going to schools and universities doing this work. And so I do think the tide is going to turn a little bit. And I'm actually optimistic that schools are going to get better at doing this work. But we have a really long way to go. And so if families can buttress that as it happens, that'll be even better.
What gives you hope? What gives you hope for the next generation?
Well, I do think this funding turnaround is something that's really, really good in the sense that we're going to have more money that goes to train social studies teachers, more money that goes to developing curricula that other teachers can deploy in their classroom. So that is good for me. But I also know that there's no sense in walking through the rest of my life or a young person's life thinking that it's going to only get worse. Going through it in a hopeful, optimistic way is the path forward, in the sense that we can only shape the way we dream by giving an expectation of positivity. And so I find that most of my students, some of them will come in jaded, but if they can see their own agency, if they can understand that like this is something that is changeable, politics is not fixed, that's really powerful. And I think that sort of agency is an antidote to a lot of the other things that are plaguing young people, namely like anxiety, depression, the idea that you're isolated. Having a purpose, having the agency to change the outcome, that's actually a really powerful thing for kids to have. Local politics certainly gives opportunities to do that because it's repeated, purposeful interactions with people who you live with. And so I think there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic.
This last question, and we only have a minute. What did I not ask you about? Any words of wisdom, real quick, that you would like to share with the listening audience?
Something that I always like to stress is that raising a citizen is different than raising a partisan. Raising a citizen is like raising an athlete. That means they understand the rules to the game, they've practiced, they've done scrimmages, and then they're ready to play. Raising a partisan is way more like raising a spectator, because all you're doing is learning, like, what colors do you paint your faces? What are the chants that you're going to do? Who are you going to boo? Who are you going to cheer? And in politics, we are all athletes, whether we like it or not. So you want to raise your child to be as strong an athlete as possible. Let them pick the teams later. If they end up in a party that's not the party that you prefer, that's not a marker of failure. Our best social science research says it's about a coin toss that you can get the outcome you want anyway. So teach them to be the best athletes possible and trust that they'll pick the team that makes sense for them.
Well, time out, and thanks to Dr. Lindsay Cormack for a thoughtful and energizing conversation on her book, How to Raise a Citizen, at the time when civic engagement seems very fragile. Much appreciation to my listening audience for the privilege of your time and ear. I invite you to tune in next week, same time, same place, to get the 411 on 411 Team. 411 Team was produced by Dr. Liz Hollyfield. Technical assistance was provided by Evan Rossi. If you would like to participate in the 411 Team or have suggestions for discussion topics, call 850-645-7200. You can listen to previous episodes of 411 Team at wfsu.org.